The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled, How Did They Live in Antiquity?, is the 11th of a 12-part series from the fall of Betar to the completion of the Mishnah. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas Yitzchak ben Moshe Olav HaSholem, Mr. Edward Marcus of blessed memory.
One of H.G. Wells' most intriguing stories was The Time Machine, a story of a man who traveled through time to a different age and era. Imagine if you had a time machine. Where would you like to travel? To some critical point in history, to prevent an assassination or a catastrophe with your knowledge of the present? Or perhaps you'd like to travel to Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, on the day when the Torah was given. Or to be with the Maccabees when the temple was dedicated and the oil burned for 8 days. The possibilities are endless. Tonight, I would like to take you on an adventure through time, to our ancient past, to relive life as it was in the time of Rav Yehuda HaNasi, Rav Yehuda the Prince, Patriarch. We'll walk through the same streets he walked, go to the same baths, eat the same meals. In short, we'll try to defy the strictures of time and place to gain an intimate view of the way life was then lived. In a previous lecture titled Diaspora, we discussed the effect the diaspora had on Jewry, as well as the effect that Jewry and Judaism had on their host nations. Although we may touch on some of the same issues that were previously covered, on the whole, this lecture is new and unique. I hope that this reenactment of ancient life will give you a better appreciation of our past, as well as a deeper understanding of the Talmud and Mishnah. But before we embark on a journey of such magnitude, we must, of course, first make the proper preparations. Generally, before you travel to any destination across the globe, you'll need to know two things. What language do they speak? And what kind of currency do they use? Regarding the language of our destination, Palestine, in the year 175 of the Common Era, let Rav Yehuda HaNasi himself tell you. It's on the handouts on page 1. Rabbi stated, this is Rav Yehuda HaNasi, why use the Syriac language in Eretz Yisrael, Lashon Sursi, which was the common language, where either the holy tongue or the Greek language could be employed? In other words, Rav Yehuda HaNasi was complaining that the common language was Sursi, was Syriac, a form of Aramaic. He says, there are better choices of languages, Lashon HaKodesh, the holy tongue, or Greek. But the truth is, though, the Jews generally did not speak either Greek or Lashon HaKodesh, but rather they spoke Aramaic. And it's telling, the quote that we have in paragraph B in the first section, from Josephus. In describing his work, his history, which from the beginning of the world until his own time, he says, I have taken great deal of pain to obtain the learning of the Greeks and understand the elements of the Greek language. He wrote it in Greek. Although I have so long accustomed myself to speak our own tongue, that I cannot pronounce Greek with sufficient exactness. For our nation does not encourage those that learn the language of many nations. Evidently, in his time, Greek was not widely spoken by Jews. The language that was spoken was was Syriac, was Aramaic. And that's the language we'll have to brush up on before our trip. So first, we'll have to brush up on Aramaic, but a smattering of Greek will most certainly help. And after we've done our research and we've taken care of the language, we better take care of the issue of money. Now, I'm sure in those days they didn't take American Express. And horror of horrors, they didn't take Visa or MasterCard either. Even the portraits of George Washington, Grover Cleveland, Benjamin Franklin wouldn't go too far. So before we go, our first destination is to a stamp and coin store, where we pick up enough ancient currency to last us for our trip. But let me first teach you the elements of the monetary system of the second century. The most basic coin was the pruta, the penny. The Talmud explains in Kedushin, Yud Beis Amud Aleph in 12a, there were 8 pennies, prutos, to the smallest silver coin called an isser. An isser was the smallest silver coin. So there are 8 prutas in 1 isser. There are 2 isserim, issers, in 1 punjan. Punjan was the next step up. There were 2 punjanim in a maw. The common word for money in Hebrew is maos. Besides mammon, it's maos. That comes from the word maw. So there are 8 prutas in 1 isser, 2 isserim in a punjan, 2 punjan in a maw. So that brings us, how much do we have over here? We have 32 prutas in, we have 32 prutas in a maw. There are 6 maw in a dinar. A dinar is the Roman coin denarius. It was similar to the Greek coin, the drachma. So we have 6 times 32. So we have 192 prutas, pennies, in a dinar. There are 4 dinorim, 4 dinars, drachmas, in a sella. A sella is the equivalent of the shekel of the Torah. So it's 4 times 192, which, so how much do we have 4 times 192? So it's 32. You have to take away 32. 768. The quote that we have over here, section 2, paragraph A, right, has it that there's 1,536 prutas in 2 siloyim. Let me put on a thinking cap. Alright, it works out. So that gives you a sense of the monetary system here. The shekel of the Torah, according to the Gemara, was equivalent to a common coin that was used then in antiquity. And this was the shekel tsuri. This is the Tyrian shekel. The face of this is the face has Hercules on the front. That isn't how they show it in the books. And this is an eagle on the obverse, reverse side. The weight of this shekel was approximately 14.1 grams. Almost like a half an ounce. And was made up of between 92 and 96% silver and the rest alloy. Its size was approximately 22 or so millimeters, just short of an inch. And that was the diameter. This was the size and weight, by the way, of the shekels that were minted between the year 66 and 70 by the Jews in Yerushalayim who declared their independence from Rome. As when they made another shekel, as we're going to see soon, it had the same size and weight. This particular shekel was discontinued in the year 61 of the Common Era. And in its place, Roman coins were now used. This is, if you don't remember, is Nero. And this is the Roman eagle on the reverse side. The coin made by Nero was a larger coin than the one that was minted in Tyre. The Talmud speaks about the Sella Neronis, the larger coin that had Nero's likeness. And the diameter here was between 25 and 26 millimeters, a little over an inch. Now the other was 22, so you know, this is 25, 26. This is 25.4 millimeters to an inch. So it gives it a little, there's a sense it's about an inch, a little over an inch. This is supposed to be the likeness of Trajan, Traianus. And his, these coins, the one of Trajan, the ones before, at the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt, they took these coins and they minted on top of them. In other words, what they did was that they heated them up, I guess, and they put on their image on this. On some of them you can still see the old image of the old coins. This is a smaller coin. This is an image of Antoninus Pius. He was the Caesar who ruled after the Bar Kokhba revolt. Now, this one is a smaller coin. But before you make a large purchase of Roman coins in the coin store, there are a few things to keep in mind. First, don't use coins that are offensive to the current regime. That means the use of the coins minted by the Jews in their war of independence will not be accepted in Roman-dominated Palestine, because you just can't use those coins. Now, the coins of an enemy are also not acceptable. This is a picture of one of the Persian kings. The Parthians, later the Persians, were constant enemies of the Romans. So don't buy any Persian coins. Now, so you're going to go just buy Roman non-Jewish coins. These are the coins, these are shkolim that were minted at the time of the Jewish revolt from the year 66 to the year 70. In fact, let's see what this one was minted in the year 66, 67, 68, and 69. In the year 70, which was the date of the fall, there are very few coins that are extant. But in Masada, I believe they did find a coin that was minted on that last year as well. These are coins which are minted at the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt. If you notice, this is supposed to be the likeness of the temple. This is a harp, a kinor. These are grapes. What? The language is the script is ancient Hebrew. It's Ksav Ivri. It's like the Phoenician script. This, by the way, I want you to know as you're going there. The money that you have is large coinage. You will have to be exchanged for smaller denominations. This is a banker's counter. This is the shulchan. This is the table which the money changers change their money. And that's what he is called. The banker is called the shulchani. And this, he is the one of the shulchan of the table. This is the banker's table. Make sure, though, when you buy your coins, that they're of standard weight. Because if it's too used, the weight will be diminished. And first and foremost, they were very careful about the weight. If you have on page 2 of your notes, in paragraph C, it refers to to problems. This is dealing with the problems of crime. If one stole money, and one has to return it, but if it has changed and became worthless, one has to pay not the original money stolen, but its monetary equivalent. And one of the grounds to say that the coin is no longer usable if it's cracked. People won't accept it. Another problem is on paragraph D, if it has to be used so much that the weight is down, it won't be accepted. In fact, if you use it for purchases and after the person weighs it and finds it's deficient, it's grounds to claim that there was a mistake made and one could get his money back. And there's a whole argument as to what percentage does it have to be missing in order to claim that it's a missale. In other words, that the coin you gave me is too light, it's it doesn't qualify, it doesn't have the correct dimensions. If you notice, remember what we just said before, Rabbi Meir said, if a shekel is missing 4 issers, right, which is an isser per dinar, it's deficient. Now, do you remember what we just said? What would the percentage be here? Remember, we'll try it again. There's 8 prutas. We'll look at it. 8 prutas and an isser. Right? 2 issers in a punjan. 2 punjanim in a maw. And 6 maw in a dinner. So it comes out 1 isser then is 1/24 of a dinner. Right? 2 issers, 2 punjanim, 6 ma, 2 times 2 times 6 is 24. According to Rabbi Meir, then, if it's deficient 1/24, it's called a missed sale. In other words, you can ask your money back. Rabbi Yehuda says 4 punjans, not 4 issers, but 4 punjans, which is 1 punjan per dinner. There's 2 punjanim in a ma, 6 ma, in a dinner, so that's 1/12. And Rabbi Shimon says 8 punjans for a sela, which is 2 punjans in a dinner. Right? 2 punjans then is a ma, 1/6. But they were very careful to make sure that it is considered, it should have the correct weight. So when you go to the store, make sure that you weigh the coin. Remember we said the tyrian, right, the weight of the of the tyrian was 14.1 grams.
Do you have any clue on the source of the differences? I mean, do all differences based upon some form of derisa or what they refer to? What was the source of the differences?
They had a tradition that the seller of the Torah, there's the shekel, the Torah dealt with everything, the shekel, which the Torah has a monetary system, the shekel of the Torah, which is mentioned, is the equivalent of the Tyrian shekel, was 14.1 grams. And that was that they had by tradition. And then they just applied then just the rest of the monetary system and divided it up. To give you a sense of the buying power, in order to, you shouldn't, put all your money into this coin, into this investment of coins. Just what would money buy in those days? So, on paragraph E on page 2, this is referring to the laws of tzedakah. This is taken from the 8th parak, the 8th chapter in the tractate Peah, in the 7th and the 8th Mishnah. A poor man that's traveling from place to place was given a loaf of bread that one could have two meals from that loaf of bread. The cost of that loaf of bread was a punjin. Okay, remember the punjin we just spoke about? Punjin is a 12th of a dinar, a 48th of a shekel. That's the cost of a loaf of bread, which would be enough bread for a day. To give you another sense, there were certain entitlements for the poor in antiquity. There was a Maaser Oni, there was a tithe that was given, distributed to the poor every 3 years. There was Peah, the section of the field was given to the poor. If one owned 200 dinarim, 200 dinars, which was like 50 shekels, one would not be entitled to be, that was the poverty line. One would not be entitled to get those entitlements. So, because it's considered 50 shekels, 200 dinarim, was the minimum, was the poverty level that you could, afford shelter and clothing and food. So that's 50 shekels was how much it took to live for a year. Now this is going to be just a very short trip, so we don't have to take all that much money with us. Okay? Now let's go into the time machine. Strap ourselves in. And I'll be your guide as we travel to the Roman province of Palestine in the year 175. You have to use your imagination here. We arrive outside a village near the city of Tiberias, Tiberia. But before we walk in, let me tell you a little bit about life in the village, because we're outside of a village. You have on page 2, to give you a sense of what life was like. According to Josephus, this is on the bottom of page 2 in section 3, it seems that most Jews lived in the countryside, at least in his time. Describing how life was amongst Jews is very telling. He says, "As for ourselves, therefore, we neither inhabit a maritime country," because even though, of course, on Israel they have a coast, but the coastline was inhabited by Greeks. "Nor do we delight in merchandise." Evidently, in his time, Jews, by and large, were not involved in the mercantile trades. "Nor in such a mixture with other men as arises from it. But the cities we dwell in are remote from the sea, and having a fruitful country for our habitation, we take pains in cultivating that only." Evidently, according to his picture of, we have a great population involved in agriculture. Our principal care of all of this is to educate our children well. And we think it to be our most necessary business of our whole life, to observe the laws that have been given us, to keep those rules of piety that have been delivered down to us. His picture is a picture. Basically, Jews make their living through agriculture, even though those who live in the city seem to be connected somehow to the fields outside the cities. We do know, and this is on page 3, that the cities were supplied, of course, in their needs by the villages. In fact, as a sign of gratitude, that those who live outside the cities supply all the needs of food and water to the cities, there was a special dispensation regarding the reading of the Megillah, that those outside the cities were allowed to read under certain circumstances a few days earlier than the regular reading. That day coincided to the day they would normally go into the cities on Mondays and Thursdays. According to the Talmud Yerushalmi, they used to come into the cities to hear the reading of the Torah on Mondays and Thursdays. According to Rashi, they would come in, this is when the courts sat in session on Mondays and Thursdays. So there was a bias for Jews to go from the villages to the cities on Mondays and Thursdays. But that Monday and Thursday happened to be before the time of the Purim, in order that they don't have to make two trips. They allow them to come earlier on Monday and Thursday to hear the Megillah. But it's our sign of appreciation. The needs of the city were supplied by those in the country. There were differences in life, of course. The necessities were in the city. I mean, the city still had all kinds of trades and professions, and those weren't available out in the little towns and the little villages. Of course, as we have here in paragraph C in page 3, the downside of living in the city was the crowded conditions. The air was not so pure. The problem here in paragraph D, in the large cities, there was a lot much more corruption, robbery, adultery, vain and false oaths, because in the courtrooms, there's a certain sense that life was harder, but more simpler, more honest, more moral in the countryside. According to Josephus, there were enormous amounts of Jews who lived out in the countryside. At the end, in page 4, the end of paragraph E, the cities lie here very thick. There are very many villages here, so full of people, by the richness of their soil, that the very least of them contain above 15,000 inhabitants in these little villages. And speaking about the Galilee, was full of these villages. But life in the villages was difficult. And in fact, the Talmud, looking at the whole scene, disapproves, in fact, of one making one's livelihood through agriculture. And there's a fascinating comment here in paragraph F on page 4. Rabbi Lozer said, "No occupation is inferior to that of agricultural labor." It says, "V'yerdu," says that they, about Adam, says about man subduing the life around him, and the wildlife in the fields, but it's spelled the same way as v'yerdu, going down. And derives, it's a step down. Rabbi Lozer once saw a plot of land that was being plowed across its width. And he says, you know, if you planted it widthwise and lengthwise, you kept on plowing it to make the soil extra fine, and to keep on, it would grow better crop, it's engaging in business would still be more profitable. And Rob once enters, says, amongst, he came to a thing of growing ears of corn, and they were swaying in the wind. And they said, you know, you could sway as much as you want. You know, says, but business brings in much more profit. And Rava said, 100 zuz, an investment of 100 zuz in business and merchandise you turn over, means meat and wine every day. 100 zuz in the land, says, is only salt and vegetables, and that's all you have, is just a very difficult life. This is making your livelihood from the soil. Furthermore, it costs to sleep on the ground, as he has to protect this thing, he has to watch it, embroils him in strife in terms of boundary disputes. But despite the fact that they look askance, that one makes one's livelihood, you know, out of farming, it still seems that they looked at it still, that if one has a small plot of land, that one at least has one's necessities. And as the one, it isn't that one makes his profit. The one has his necessities. He says, at least you're self-sufficient. And the Republic says, plant, says, and don't buy. And there's, even if the cost is the same, there's a blessing in planting. And as you have this, there's enough to be self-sufficient, but your profit, where your money should be invested, is it should be invested in merchandise. This is fascinating. But life in the not only was it difficult being a farmer, it seems that much of the luxuries that were available in the city were not available in the villages. On page 5, it deals with the kind of peasants' platters that were much more coarse than that which was used, that was eaten in the cities. In many of the villages and the outlying areas, they were really near forests. And they would have to be very careful to bring in their flocks while it was still daylight. They shouldn't be caught towards evening, and the wild animals are leaving their lairs in the forest and they'll go and attack. So you have that problem as well. Bathing was a problem, living in the villages. In fact, there's a fascinating, it's a passage of Talmud Yerushalmi. And the Talmud Yerushalmi is dealing with the thing of oaths, that a man makes an oath not to have pleasure from his wife, or contingent on the fact that she shouldn't take a bath for a certain amount of time. And it says that the limit, if he imposes it where it becomes too difficult, she can go to the courts and demand a divorce. So the nature of the vow is that in the city, if he makes the vow that's continuous, she shouldn't take a bath for a week. That's enough for divorce. But in the villages, it would be for 2 weeks. In the villages, evidently, they took it for less frequently. In terms of wearing shoes, if she made an oath for a woman in the village, she shouldn't wear shoes, that oath would have to be for 3 months. Because evidently they would go for months without wearing shoes. In the city, it would be for 24 hours. It would be considered too much of a hardship. In other words, in the city, you wore shoes. In the villages, they went barefoot, evidently. In other words, it's very common. There was another class of people. There were Jewish nomads. Because here we're dealing with people who live out in the villages. But there were Jewish nomads. And it says of people who live in these huts and travelers in the deserts, as in paragraph K, lead a miserable life. And one of the, I think, they have no bathhouses. And we'd say, there was problems, the Rashi says, that when men would leave, they would go from time to time to the city to take a bath and leave their wives alone. And it was a problem, perhaps, that when the village would be deserted, perhaps some man, wandering man would come in. It was a problem of having an affair with one of the women. Even on its own merit, not having baths itself was a problem. So if we're going to go into the village, you have to be prepared to go to a place where basically they're barefoot, they don't take baths, live a very Spartan existence, and I think we'll forego going into the village, and we're going to go straight into the city. But I'd just like to show you some of the artifacts here. This is an oil press. The olives were placed in here, and this was moved around, these millstones, to press these olives. This is a hand mill. The flour went down here, and the friction between the top and the bottom caused the wheat, or whatever it is, to be milled. These are actual mills from Pompeii. Pompeii was the city that was, year 79, that was the Mount Vesuvius, rained on it ashes. The city was covered with ashes. The populace, those that did not manage to flee, were buried alive. It was uncovered, allegedly, in Pompeii, and we're going to see other pictures of Pompeii. Virtually, you see life as it was, untouched from antiquity. As we're going to leave our time machine, we've decided not to go into the village. We're going into the city. We're going to cross over this bridge. This particular bridge from this picture here is the Mulvian Bridge over the Tiber, which has been in use for almost some 2,000 years. The Romans were tremendous bridge builders and road builders. They were constructed very soundly. The roads were paved very well. As we're going to see further on, there are roads that were paved by the Romans that are still in use today. In fact, when the we studied this in previous class, Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi was praising the Roman contribution to life in Palestine, special mention was about their building bridges. But before we enter the city, let me tell you a little about city life. One of the advantages of city life is the availability of all kinds of artisans and their services. If you'll notice here, briefly on page 6, there's a discussion of the different artisans that are mentioned in the Talmud. And the first quotation here on page 6 is a city has to have a minimum of certain services. One of them is one needs a rofe, which Rashi defines as a circumciser. It seems from the Rambam that's defined as a doctor. And also a bloodletter, which was the common doctor of the time. These, if you notice, are Roman surgical instruments that were taken from Pompeii. Many are very similar to what they are used in modern times. There's a scalpel, and this is this. In the cities, you had the schools. Here, and you had scribes. This is a tablet, which was mentioned in the Mishnah, which is common at the time. It's a wooden tablet, has a recessed area where you put wax. And writing was done on these wax tablets. Here's a wax tablet. This is papyrus, which was the equivalent of our paper. We'll go into it soon. This was an inkwell. These were pens. The pen was made out of reeds. They weren't the quills that are commonly used today to write a Sefer Torah. It was used to write the Declaration of Independence. Actually, they were hollow reeds that they were cut to a point, and they were cut in the middle over here. And this was how the pen was used. These is the papyrus plant. These are the reeds that made paper. They were very long plants. They were cut down into strips, thin strips,
boxes that were maybe around 3 inches long, and they cut down, so the whole thing was cut down into strips. And they were laid down, these little strips, to, across, let's say, across a table, which to make, would be like to make like the size of a long strip of paper. Then they would be glued, and counterclockwise, going the other grain, and there's one is going horizontal, you know, vertically, horizontal this, it was glued to it other strips of these papyrus reed, so it stuck together. So you had strips going this way, vertically, and strips going horizontally. They were glued together, they were immersed in water, they made a supple, they were pressed out, and they eventually had the feel of regular paper, and that's how this was made to, this was used to write on. These are various pens, you know, the pen, and these are still styli, the stylus that was used to write in the wax tablet. You know, the wax tablet had these, you know, had the sharp, and if you notice in some of them, has a sharp end here, has a flat end up here. Because when you were finished and wanted to rewrite it, you would erase it with the flat end, right, and then start again. This is a loom. This is an ancient loom. And this is the chassis. These are the things of the warp. And then there'd be a special thing that would go across a shuttle, and would make the weft. These are carpenter tools. These are some of them. Here is a there's a square, a triangle. This is a plumb line. This is a saw. This is a hammer. So that's why I decided to take you into the city. Okay? We go into the city, the way you look, I mean, it's a dead giveaway. You come from the 20th century, right? See, the first thing is you have to blend in. You know, when in Rome, or when in Bavaria. So, one of the first things you need is to get a new set of clothing. But these are sandals. This is taken from the Bar Kokhba caves. This is in the time of the shortly before our time. This was taken from Masada. These sandals, very much like the sandals today. These are signs. These are Roman shoes. There's a hobnailed shoe. This is a very common sandal or shoe, which is used by Roman soldiers. This is taken from a sculpture. One of the common articles of clothing was the cholok, the tunic. This is a picture here. There's a belted tunic. You can see they have the belt, and this is the common clothes. This is the tunic. Yeah, it was originally, it's really one, it's sewed together to be one piece. It really starts with two pieces of, we're going to see, it's two pieces of cloth that are sewn together, which form a hole for the head. And then after the sides were sewn, this is a Roman tunic found in Egypt. This shirt was found in the Bar Kokhba caves, where those were running from, those from the feet of Betar. But this is a shirt taken from them. This, as you see, this also is taken from the Bar Kokhba caves. As you notice, there are two pieces which are sewn together, and this is the opening for the head. You notice the purple design here. This is the sign of the... So it wasn't a plain shirt, it was... This, as you notice, the Romans didn't wear pants. This, however, is a foreign... These are called brachii. These are pants. They were worn by foreigners. We know that their trousers, we find, are described in the Talmud. This was a. This is evidently not a Roman. Perhaps it's a Gaul. This is a. This is a prisoner. Notice the hat.
Some of the scribes, 18 articles of dress. This is in terms of if one is allowed to save clothing from a fire, you can put on all this clothes. There's 18 to be the well dressed person. There's 18 articles of clothing that very would seem very much the statue of the person before was totally dressed. But we'll need, after we buy all our purchase of clothing, we will have to go and to put it all in a bag so we can carry our other clothing that we change. This is a bag which was found in the caves of those who ran away at the defeat of Betar. This is a shopping bag. This is made out of what? Yeah. It's a it seems to be made from willow, is the same thing one would make a basket, the same material. And this is actually it's an amazing thing. This is a shopping bag. In antiquity, they didn't have telephone booths. So the place to change, we have to go to a bathhouse. The bath was very common in antiquity. There's many sections of the Talmud deal with various sections of a bath. But just by the way here, this is jewelry. This is gold jewelry. There's some of it is very, very similar, if you can get a good look, of what's worn today. This is a necklace. There's earrings. It's all kind of... This is the entrance to a bathhouse. This is a large bathhouse. This is in Pompeii. As you entered in, the Talmud speaks about a room where one takes off one's coat and hat, one takes off the major articles of clothing. And here are cubicles that one could put one's clothing. Well, they tell me also. This is how one entered. This is a poem from Bath in England, an ancient Bath. Notice it's very ornate. It was a major structure, a bathhouse. The Talmud describes two dressing areas, the overclothing and the rest. From the dressing area, we took out the major, which was an unheated room, we walk into a warm anteroom, which is probably where they finished the dressing, which is known in Latin as a tepidarium, which the bathers waited until perspiration started. They didn't want to go immediately into the hot environment in order to avoid the danger of passing too subtly to the higher temperatures. This is of the next room. Then from there, when they were acclimated, they had taken their clothes off, they went into the hot room, which was known as the caldarium in Latin. Yeah, listen. In addition to the hot room, there was often a room for a sweat bath, known as, which is described at length in the Talmud, called a Laconicum. This was generally built directly above the furnace with a hot room adjacent to it. And so first you had below was the furnace. On top was a room, if it was a very ornate thing, that had a separate room just for a schwitz, another just to sweat. Next to it, not as hot, but a hot room, was the hot room where one took a hot bath. And next to it was, further from this furnace, was the warm room. The collapse of the bath floor onto the burning furnace was not an uncommon occurrence. And if you notice, on page 10, there's a special prayer that said when one leaves the bathhouse in one piece. When Rabbi Abo once went to a bathhouse, the floor of the bathhouse gave way, and a miracle was wrought for him, and he stood on a pillar and rescued 101 men with one arm. In other words, they're all holding on for dear life. After the hot treatment, you know, so the person went, took off his clothes, went to the warm room, the hot room, the Bailey would have his perspiration scraped with a tool known as a strigilis. We're going to see a picture of it soon. And they would plunge into a cold bath known as a frigidarium. It was very common. They went from the hot bath to the cold bath. Or sometimes they just went and poured cold water over them. Here on page 10 in paragraph D, we have the statement of Shmuel, the Gemara in Shabbos, in Mem Aleph and 41a. If one bathes in hot water, does not take a cold shower bath, it's like iron put into a fire, but not put into cold water afterwards. Afterwards, he would be scraped again after the cold, and he would be given an oil treatment. And this we have in the one Shabbos, if one bathes without anointing, he's like water poured over a barrel, like nothing goes inside. In other words, to keep the water in the pores, and not, so it was after smeared with oil, so to maintain, maintain the water should be there, and the moisture should be maintained in the, you know, in the skin. Often this was done in a special room called an unctorium. This is the oil flask, and these are the two strigils. These were used to scrape the body from sweat before the, you know, before the final anointing. In the large bathhouse of Pompeii, there was also a special woman's bathhouse, in addition to an exercise court, a bowling alley, a swimming pool, and showers. As you notice, the source of the water of these particular baths in Tiberias are the famous Chame Tiberia, the hot springs, which Tiberias is so famous. Hopefully, you're all refreshed, you've taken the bath, and go on to take a tour of the streets and byways of the city. This is a Roman pavement which is still in use after 2,000 years. The streets were made very well. The general setup of the streets, the structure of the homes, at least described in the Talmud, as it was in Palestine, was they lived, the homes were in chatzeros, were in courtyards. There were walled courtyards that had homes. The courtyards were connected, there was an alleyway off the street, like a private way that one went into these various courtyards. In other words, there would be, you'd have walls, you'd walk on the alleyway, there'd be walls on both sides. Every once in a while there'd be a door, you walk in the door and you'd enter into a courtyard. The courtyard was called the chutzer. The alleyway was called the Movoi. And from this alleyway, this private way, one walked into the main street. The main street, the Talmud describes, was a place not only of flow of traffic, but also of sales. And very often in the street or by the street, there was areas of columns where people would sit near benches and have their wares. The sidewalk on the side was raised, as described in the Talmud, from the rest of the street. People would walk on the sidewalk, as well as on the street, where animals would have the free rein of the streets. It seems, though, in Roman, as we find in Pompeii, you had the homes right off the streets. Instead of going off these alleyways, we described before, the alleyways into these courtyards, in Pompeii, it was really as we have today. The houses were on the streets. This is a picture in Ostia, there's a model of what was left. Of an apartment house. The apartment house were very much like apartment houses today. This happens to be 4-5 stories. It's a very large apartment house. And it was very common, and Talmud speaks about the aliyahs, about people living in the second story, because in the city you had to build up because of the population. This is taken from a fresco in Pompeii. This is about how it looked with the houses. This is a picture of what houses are in the city. So this is a picture of that. You see houses upon houses. I don't know if you notice here. It keeps on going up and up. Like they were just... It was very crowded. In large homes that we find from the period, it seems that it was built in such a way that there were stores, they built these large structures, that they could rent out rooms in front of their home, unattached. The entrance was on the street, not to their home. So they would rent those out for income. And in between the stores, there would be an entranceway. In other words, like it would be a large building. And there would be an entrance to the house part. And one would walk in from the street, like in between the stores, so to speak, on this side. And one would come into the door. That area, that was one walked from the street, and the stores are on one side, the stores are on the other side, and you're walking straight through, that was known as the Proizdor. This was the entrance hall. This is on page D. This world is considered, this is in Pirkei Avos, Doma LeProizdor. It's like the vestibule. But it's not, it seems from antiquity, this was really this place which you entered off of the street. And as you walked in, you fix yourself up, whatever it is, before your appointment, you walk inside. This is, as we see, this is a doorway, similar to what is from Pompeii, of evidently this door, if it still is in existence, is probably a metal door. And it's very common that they had doors made out of metal, as well as the bolt, the lock. If you notice this, it turns, if you can see it on this picture, it turned not as we have as hinges on the side, but the doors, there were sockets that protruded below the door. It turned in a hole that was on the floor. It was below here, and there was part of the door protruded, this little thing, and that swung. And this is how it swung open. These are keys from antiquity. This is taken from the Bar Kokhba caves. These, just to give it the size of them, this is a signet ring on the bottom. That's the size of a ring, so these are the sizes of the... Like basically this was a hole you carry with you, your whole sock. This was your doorknob with you.
And there's a special contraption you put it in, it fed into that you're able to open the door. This did not lend itself for large keychains. What's the next one? Okay, so go back. The main room was called the atrium. That was the main room of a Roman house. There was generally a hole in the roof where one got air. And if it rained, there would be a hole in the floor, a basin in the floor, which would catch the rain from the hole, up on the hole in the roof was known as the compluvium. And it was very common. This is how light was achieved in the main room. Beyond the main room, in the back, one had the gardens. This is a picture of the gardens, and this is the column gardens, as it was in one of the homes in Pompeii. This is where they reconstructed it, but this is how things look. It's pretty neat. And that they had dining rooms on the side. The general plan of the luxurious house had the main room, and what is it? This is the atrium with the hole in the roof. And you keep on going past that, you'd go into the gardens in the back. This, and you can see how the beds were. The beds were supported. This was before Seeley came out with his Posturepedic. It was supported by a mesh work. There were straps that went in and out, generally. This is not a bed, so this is really a litter. This is the people they used to carry, the slaves used to carry this as you walked into the marketplace. So, but this was the, if you see, this is the mesh work. This is how the, this is where the mattresses were put. This was how the bed looked in antiquity. And here it is now. Here is the mattress on it. Here is a cushion. It was very tall, and there was a footstool. See, here's a footstool. There's a table. This is a very common. This is how the beds look. And in fact, sometimes the Talmud speaks about canopy beds, isn't that? Where they'd be protruding from the four sides, there would be a frame, and on the frame you would be a canopy, and in antiquity it would protect against the insects. It was just very common. This was in those days. Generally, people had two beds at least per person. One was the bed that you slept in, and one was the bed that you ate on, because they didn't eat on chairs. They ate on beds. And they reclined on the beds while they ate. In Rome, the table was much like our table, a large table. The people reclined next to the table. Actually, the Roman table really had three, there was a large couch next to each side of the table where three people reclined per couch. In Palestine, in Israel, they actually had individual couches, and they had small tables given to each person. This is the Delphica, this particular table is described in the Mishnah, but this is a small table typical of what was given, and that's, you were given a small table and you ate on that table. Yeah. Sarah? This is taken from the Bar Kochba caves. This is glass tableware. This is a glass plate. They ate on. Now, if you want, we can arrange to get a meal. But first you gotta know, before the meal, when they eat. First thing is, really, the meal was generally a little later in the day. You just took a little bit of something when you woke up, and that's known as pas shachris. Like, you took a little bit in the morning. On page 15, we have the order of when people ate. The first hour is the mealtime, Michael Ludim. Rashi in terms of Ludim as cannibals. Others said the Ludim, as we're going to see, as gladiators. They woke up very early in the morning for their exercises. The second was for robbers who were up all night, and they wanted a meal before they went to sleep. The third is for Yorshan, they don't have to work. So they woke up late and they ate a regular meal. The fourth is for laborers. The Gemara really changes this. The fourth is for normal working people, and they take something early in the morning and they have a meal on the fourth hour. Agricultural laborers ate on the fifth hour, and scholars ate in the sixth hour. In other words, they were learning in the base medrash, the study hall, until the sixth hour, where they stopped to have a meal. Page 16 on the top. The food was put, as we had before the person. After the meal, much of what they ate was with their hands in those days. So they washed their hands afterwards, and very often they would rub their hands with oil as well, fragrant oil, after the meal. But let's go now, we know, give you a sense of what it was to go to a banquet. Here's pretend this is, we're invited, we've taken the bath, we've taken a tour of the city, we're invited for a meal. We sit down, the bottom of page 16, the guests enter and sit on benches. This is the first thing, or cathedra chairs. And the word cathedra really comes from that. The word cathedral. Because the cathedral is the seat of the bishop. And the cathedral was an ornate chair, which really was half reclining. People used to come in first, water would be brought and wash one hand, wine was brought to them, and they would make a bracha, and they would drink the wine. This is before they were really invited to the meal. And they would sit and they would schmooze. Then they would go to the part where they're going to the meal. Then they'd go to the area where they would have the couches, and they would recline. Again, water would be brought to them. They would wash both hands this time. And again, they would drink wine in their new place. Very often hors d'oeuvres were given before the meal. Very often a toast would be made, as we have here on page 17. It says, Chamra v'chayas l'fum rabbonon, wine and health to the mouth of our teachers. This is similar to the l'chaim. In fact, the toast of l'chaim we find in a Medrash Tanchuma, Parshat Pekudei, Defus of Arshan. That's not in the Buber print, but in the print of the Warsaw print. We have the idea of wishing somebody l'chaim before one drinks. This is in contradiction to when they would give someone to drink before one died, one was sentenced to be killed. And when they give them wine, with some frankincense inside to make them high, to confuse them, to take away part of the fright of being sentenced to eat it. And there it would be lamovas. And here you say this drink is l'chaim, for life. It's not... After the meal, they would have dessert. This is the afikoman. This is described here in the bottom, page 17. Mushrooms, pigeons, dates, parched ears of corn, nuts. In other words, it would be after the meal, they would have the dessert. On page 18, very often after the meal, besides the drinking, again, this is a luxurious meal. So there would be fragrant spices we put over coals, mugmor. Now, the smell of perfume would fill the room. It's not bad. Okay, we've taken our bath. We've had a wonderful meal. You know, let's go around. We've seen the city a little bit. In the year 175, this was the year that Marcus Aurelius came to Tiberias. The place was full of soldiers. This is a picture of a soldier as it was under Augustus Caesar. This is a picture of a soldier later on in the time of Trajan. You notice that both is, notice the special Roman shield. This one doesn't have... Can you turn back? You don't see it over here. Very often they had greaves, which was a protection over the calf, the lower legs. Now here is the male armor. The Romans... had these pylons, these javelins, and how they fought in war was they used to throw these javelins, these at the enemy, you know, at the enemy's formation, and either it would kill the enemy or would lodge into the enemy's shield, and it was made in such a way that once it hit, it bent, so the weight of it caused the enemy's shield to be very unwieldy. And then he came in for the kill with the special, with his sword. The Roman sword is called the gladius, and that's where the word gladiator comes from. And I think it would be interesting to go to a gladiator fight. Even though the Talmud looks askance at attending these form of Roman entertainment, but for the sake of perhaps we could save a life or better understand the passages of the Talmud, we'll take the liberties tonight of going to a gladiator fight. This is a arena. This is an amphitheater. This is in Verona, Italy, where. This is where the action took place. They had special schools of gladiators. The game itself was called ludi. That's why some explained the Michael Ludum described before. Ludi is actually refers to the public, the gladiators. The sword is the gladius. And the school for gladiators was called, was the ludi gladiatorius. Gladiators usually fought in pairs, man against man. This is another, this is in Pompeii. Sometimes they fought against beasts. Through time, though, certain gladiator equipment became more or less standard. There was heavy armor, which consists of a helmet with a visor. This is the helmet with a visor. A thick sleeve on the right arm. This is the thick sleeve. A greave, this protection on the left leg. A belt, a short sword, the gladius, and a long shield. Light armor, if they were, it was just the if they had, why, was a small shield with a curved sword and greaves for both legs. It was a different type of a gladiator. The heavily armored were called the Samnites. The light armored were called the Thracians. That was a name they gave them, even though it's not. The Samnites, of course, were ancient people, but they called these soldiers, they called them. In addition, there was the equipment of the net man. You see this net? They used to throw a net over this. The thing was that they would try to throw a net over and the net man was the retiari. His whole defensive equipment, this was a leather protection for his shoulder. This person here, he was pretty. You see, he's not wearing much. His offensive equipment was a net that he threw against his opponent. If he was successful, he would finish him off with a dagger. The net would make him, he couldn't maneuver, and therefore he would just finish him off with a dagger. But if he missed, either he could try again, or the other person would go and get him. In the meantime, he had a three-pronged spear that he would try, and until he got his net, in action, he would try to fend off the other person. However, if he really missed, his career would be over. A skilled gladiator could take turns with different equipment, because he was really as an entertainer here. It was a deadly entertainment. But a skilled really could change places. He would be good with a net, or he'd be good as a Samnite, or as a Thracian. The show began with a procession of gladiators around the arena, halting before the presiding official and giving him the famous salute. This is morituri te salutant. Those about to die salute you. The program begins with a series of sham combats with blunt weapons. Now that the people have had enough, the trumpets began to signal that the real exhibition was to begin. And they fought for keeps. Those who are reluctant to fight are being driven into the arena with whips, hot iron bars. Today, besides the regular program, a few poor fellows have been condemned to fight against the lions. Notice this fellow, only armed with a small knife, facing a lion that looks quite experienced in these surroundings. Suddenly, the fellow runs to the lion and seems to whisper something in his ear. The lion gives out a scream that's heard for miles around. Running frantically here and there, the panic-stricken lion finally finds his way back to its cage, a shadow of his former self. The crowds have never seen such a sight. They wildly wave their napkins, which is a sign for clemency. The former prisoner is led out triumphantly. As he's leaving the stadium, we take him aside and ask him, "What did you whisper to the lion?" He smiled and said, "I just told them that I'm Jewish. And when you come to a Jewish meal, you have to stay for all the speeches." I think it's time to go back to our time machine. And I hope you enjoyed this trip. Okay, are there any questions? What?
What do you know about the physiology of the human race?
I think the average height was something like 5'6", something like that. You know, basically the same. Yeah. Yeah.
On the first page with quote from the sequence about scourging.
Yes, Sanhedrin was a different thing. He's done about Jews who live by large in Palestine, and they either study Torah. In the Sanhedrin, there were a few were versed in other languages, so they could communicate in judicial matters, and as if cases would come to them from Jews from the far flung ends of the earth, so they had to understand and speak their language. What? It was looked up to, but it was really a matter of expediency. It wasn't. It was only because only for members of the Sanhedrin. It was only for that purpose.
These are people that were really, as they were moving up in the courts, they were trained in
right. But even in the Talmud describes in Yavna, shortly after the destruction of the temple, there were only three or four who were so versed in languages. In Beitar, there are three who were versed in language, but it was there weren't that many. I mean, there were some they needed, but it wasn't necessarily everyone was versed in languages.
What kind of population was there in the place that buried at that time?
It's really hard to know in light of the fact this is after the destruction of the temple, where so many millions, and after the Beitar, destruction, where we're dealing with destruction of millions of people. So it's really we really have no evidence.
Well, how many people lived in Beitar at the destruction?
The Roman historian Dio Cassius describes over 500,000 people dying.
All from Beitar.
And that from that area, but it would seem from Chazal it could be that there were much more. From other, it's hard to know if it's hyperbole or not, but they speak of millions. So there's
We read about Azura how long ago. There are many, many casual references to the way cases would arise where Jews and Goyim would sit together. They were sitting together, they were selling things to each other. Could you comment on, I always wonder, were these exceptional situations or they seem to be...
The cities were by and large were not Jewish cities and they had Jewish population. But the Jews and the non-Jews lived together. And they had relationships. I mean, at least business relationships. They had those as we have today. I mean, because they doesn't in Palestine. Sure, it was really full of really non-Jews. They were heathens. No, the Christians really. It was very small at the time they were speaking. Now, it was a relatively small Christian population. They were heathens. Right. They were pagans.
Could you comment a little further about the interface? Did the Jews, as a matter of expediency, speak Latin, or did the Goyim in Palestine know Aramaic?
Yeah. The question is about the languages. It seems that the non-Jews, the language, of the, was Greek. That was the language the non-Jews spoke. However, I mean, because it was occupied by Greeks, the Greeks came in and occupied the coast. That was the language even used by Romans, educated Romans used Greek. And it would seem, I don't know to the extent of really the knowledge of Latin was necessary. It seems to deal with non-Jews, there had to be at least some knowledge of Greek. That was the language that the Romans used. I'm sure the Aramaic was used for non-Jews as well. Syriac was not just a Jewish language, it was a Syrian language. Right. And non-Jews used it, but that was the native Syrians. Because there's different layers of non-Jews who were there. There were the natives, and on top of that there came the Greeks. And it seems that the Greeks spoke Greek. Spoke the Grecian language, spoke Greek. And that was really the language of the educated. Even Rabbi Yudanosis, as I think you speak a non-Jewish language to speak Greek. But I don't believe Latin was a language where there was any necessity to know Latin in that part of the world. I mean, in the other part, in the western part, yes. But in that part, in the eastern part, Greece was the Greek was the language. Yeah. Yes.
You did not touch on the question here about one should teach the son a craft.
I brought it as part of the idea of the The main opinion is that one should teach a child a trade, or to make a livelihood. If one is holding on the level, you know, so Rabbi Noroi says, "I will only teach my child Torah." Yeah, but it's a preferred level, perhaps. But as by and large, that was not the road taken by most people. There was as generally says, the people learned it, but the vast majority of people learned a trade. There are others, of course, even the scholars in the times of the Talmud, that even though perhaps they didn't have a trade, but they were involved in business, at least as a livelihood, in selling wine or beer, you know, different forms of livelihood.
How does it compare today?
The Rambam, just to give you a sense of what is the Rambam describing how a person should, how he should divide his day. And he says 3 hours one should devote to the study of Scripture, 3 hours to the study of Mishnah and Talmud, and 3 hours to the analysis, and 3 hours to make a living. Those scholars who were involved in a livelihood who did not spend that much part of the day involved in it. They did it in a way that it was enough to put bread on the table, enough to live on. But it wasn't, the situation then among scholars at least, wasn't like today, where generally you don't have that option. Either you're totally involved in your business, which means it's at least 8 hours or 9 hours of the day plus traveling time back and forth. You didn't have, life was not as it was that one could just be involved in the morning, so to say, or in the afternoon, and the rest of the day devote to study. It just wasn't. And it seems that those scholars who were involved in study really put the majority of their day was involved in study, and a minority of the day was involved in the livelihood. Of course, there's a great masses of people who weren't scholars who were just totally involved in the livelihood. But you think about, you know, people who were scholars, who did have a livelihood, it seems that a relatively small part of that day was devoted to the livelihood. And the lion's share was devoted to scholarship. And how life is today, it's almost impossible. I mean, it's possible, but it's very, generally, the opportunities we have, like, demand that you put your whole life into it. Yeah.
On the same population, I'm trying to understand. There were a large population of lay people, and there were the scholars who were listening to pick up the discussion and what is the war. There's also references to the Archicala that would come together for 2 months. There's references to don't come when I forget what the morning is about.
Yeah, this and this I quote. It seems the question was about the Yachikala. How was it amongst the scholars? You know, that it seems, at least from the time of the Gaonim, the Gaonim, and that's the way it was before. They studied basically the whole year. 2 months they had off. Nisan and Tishrei. And this was Rav advised his students during that time, I want you to be involved in a livelihood. This is the time of agricultural activity. This was the harvesting, the barley harvest in Nisan. This was in Tishrei was the ingathering. It was the pressing of the grapes. See, they needed extra agricultural workers. Make a little extra money then. The schedule was that they studied a tractate for 5 months. 4 months, people studied on their own, in their own cities, in their own yeshivas. On the fifth month, they all came together in a central location. All the great scholars from all the country, and again, they studied the material again. That was the Yarche Kala, the months of the Kala. And they covered a tractate in every 5 month period, you know, culminating again this last month, they went over it. So that in a period of some 30 years, they went over all of the Mishnayos, all of the tractates. Okay.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.